Good morning.
Good morning.
Something Cliff has brought up before concerning questions related to what would be called the philosophy of religion. And so the title of the talk, hi Peter, the title of the talk is Religion Does Not Exist and Its Non-Existence Also Does Not Exist. Religion does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. And this is the second talk in a series leading up to the Heart Sutra study session that will begin this coming Thursday. And I hope all of you will be able to be here. It starts Thursday in the late afternoon and goes Friday, Saturday, and half the day on Sunday. And during the session, we'll be going carefully through the Heart Sutra and examining its form and content so that our chanting practice of the sutra is enriched by our understanding. So the first talk I gave on the Heart Sutra was on Mother's Day, May 9th, and I brought with me Prajna Paramita, the goddess of wisdom, the mother of all of the Buddhas. And we talked about the mantra to Prajna Paramita, Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Svaha. And I love the way our time together then ended, because on the one hand, we were hearing the mantra as this encouragement, you know, gone, gone, gone beyond, go to the other shore, hurrah! And on the other hand, Giraud said that Kobun Chino Roshi, our founding teacher, heard the mantra as saying, everything is falling apart. Everything is falling apart. There's nothing we can do. And I love that contrast between the sense of striving and working and getting to the other shore, and there's nothing we can do. The Buddha's way is easy. Strive hard! A basic tension in our practice. So I was very pleased when our teacher, Mike, who just arrived after cooking, thank you for cooking, asked me to speak on this day, June 13th, because, oh, thank you. I'll take some right away. Because I knew that today would come right after the baccalaureate service at Stanford yesterday, where Eboo Patel gave a talk. And Eboo Patel is a progressive Muslim in his 30s who has founded something called the Interfaith Youth Corps. And this is something that's really catching on among university students, where students coming from a variety of faith traditions are meeting and doing public service work together in order that they may hear each other's stories. Their stories of engagement with their own faith traditions. And a lot of students are very engaged with this and very excited about it, because what's more interesting than hearing other people's stories? And what's more useful than finding out what it looks like, what other traditions look like from the inside, and finding common ground and being interested in differences? So what Eboo Patel is doing is a great service, and one that's much needed right now in our time. So yesterday in his talk, he spoke about his first encounter with Brother Wayne Teasdale, who is a Chicago Benedictine monk who actually met Eboo and got him going in this direction of interfaith. And Brother Teasdale, who died in 2004, was a student of B. Griffiths, who was another Benedictine, Christian Benedictine monk, who founded an ashram in South India and started a tradition that's now called Wisdom Christianity, which marries the New Testament teaching, the kingdom of God is within you, with the Hindu notion of Atman. Now, our tradition grew out of a notion of Anatman, no self. Right? And as I was reflecting on this wisdom Christianity and the perfection of wisdom teachings in our tradition, I was reminded of, in this world of interfaith dialogue, of interspirituality, how important it is that we really begin to engage with others and understand that our various traditions complement each other. A tradition of Atman, self, needs a tradition of Anatman, no self. And it's in this dialogue of complementarity, a theistic tradition, an atheistic tradition, that's really where the energy of insight is. And that's what I want to talk about today, with the idea that religion does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. One of the readings at the baccalaureate yesterday was from the poet Hafiz. And I want to read the poem which a student read called "I Have Learned So Much." I have learned so much from God that I can no longer call myself a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. The truth has shared so much of itself with me that I can no longer call myself a man, a woman, an angel, or even pure soul. Love has befriended Hafiz so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known. Love has befriended Hafiz so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known. At the end of the talk on Prajna Paramita on May 9th, we also thought a little bit about what I call the open space beyond religion, which is where I think the Heart Sutra brings us into this field of the open space beyond religion. How many of you have heard of the teacher Friedrich Spiegelberg? Friedrich Spiegelberg. I want to talk a little bit about him, for he was very interested in Zen and how Zen would bring people to this open space beyond religion, where religion does not exist and its non-existence also does not exist. Friedrich Spiegelberg was born in 1897, and he was a refugee from a German university in the Nazi period. There are a lot of great stories about Spiegelberg, and he ended up being a lecturer in religion at Stanford from 1941 to 1962. I've met a lot of his former students, and every former student has an amazing Friedrich Spiegelberg story to tell. He walked from Germany to Tibet in 1949, and there made some interesting discoveries, including some rare manuscripts. I think probably one of my favorite Spiegelberg stories I learned from Michael Murphy, the founder of Esalen. And Mike Murphy was in the Cubberley Lecture Hall on the campus. At that time, and this was 1950, Mike was a pre-med student, And he thought he was going to a social psychology class. But he showed up in Kabbalah, and the class had changed to a lecture by Frederick Spiegelberg, who came up on the stage and said, "Brahman!" And Michael just sat up and listened to the entire lecture and decided he has to go to India and study South Asian philosophy. And that's really the beginning of the Esalen Institute in Big Sur. Mike became a Frederick Spiegelberg student. And this was before there were teaching awards at the university, and Spiegelberg's lectures grew from Kabbalah to eventually Memorial Auditorium. And he was, and they were packed, and he was the only person on campus at the time that was teaching anything about Asian traditions. He also was one of the founders of the American Academy of Asian Studies that started in San Francisco in 1951, where Alan Watts was the dean. And this was a center where people could come from all over the Bay Area and begin to learn about Asian traditions. And Spiegelberg wrote a number of books, one I have here called Zen, Rocks, and Waters, which is about Zen aesthetics. And in doing some research on Spiegelberg, I found this a note from another one of his students, Judy Matthews. "Dr. Spiegelberg was closer to ultimate sources of inspiration than anyone I have ever known," she said. "Now, as I experience his absence, I remember the time when I told him how much I enjoyed his book, Zen, Rocks, and Waters. This prompted him to tell me that he had never liked the name of the book. His publisher had insisted Zen was very trendy at the time," this was 1961, "that the word Zen had to be included in the title. We both laughed. The original title was Vanishing into Reality. Vanishing into Reality." Dr. Spiegelberg, in 1938, produced a pamphlet called The Religion of Non-Religion. I'll send a picture around of this particular book and a photo of the Buddhist Lodge in London, which was the publisher. I actually have the actual pamphlet here, The Religion of Non-Religion. And this is how he thought about Zen. It's the religion of non-religion, whereby we vanish into reality. Right. And I want to read a little bit from this and just touch upon some of the main ideas, because I find this to be a very useful way to think about our practice. And Spiegelberg begins by telling about a mystical experience he has. It's his own experience, and he writes it as if he's thinking about a boy running along the seashore across meadows and green fields, looking at trees and bushes, enjoying the scent of the flowers and the majesty of thick white noonday clouds, and stimulated by his own vitality and youth. He's going for a walk on the ridge up there. He has just read for the first time some songs of the mystic poet Rainer Maria Rilke, and the ideas of this visionary are filling his heart, growing in his mind like seeds in a fertile soil. His usual everyday consciousness has vanished, and he feels instead something high, something holy. He will call it his higher self. And this, his new, better transmuted ego, will feel in the so-called world nothing but holiness. These waves of the ocean and the blowing of the wind are the voice of God. All these flowers and trees are full of his glory. Like Moses, he will see each bush burning in sacred fire. And like the mystic shoemaker, Jacob Bema, after having looked for a long time at his shoemaker's globe, he will see the bright glance of some superconscious sun shining from the center of every creature around him. The whole reality has become perfect and holy. Secular life has faded away, or it has changed to some better life, more real and bright, now that the former things have passed away. And while he thus enjoys for hours his new life in this transformed reality, which is nothing other than a mere testimony of God's glory and omnipresence in everything that exists, he suddenly approaches round the corner of the road a church, a zendo. And the sight of the church gives him a shock. For whatever is a church doing in this glorified world? What can be behind those stone walls? What means this colored light behind the windows? And what these strange sounds of music which reach his ears? All the world around has been holy, has been God's eternal nature, has been his face and his expression. Therefore, and this is his sudden shock, if there is really anything else, anything peculiar behind those walls, it could only be a matter outside God, standing opposite or even against this eternal bliss of the all-penetrating holiness. Why else should these walls and such buildings as churches have been so erected? The people who did it, intending to build a special place for God's so-called worship and for God's realization, did they not feel that God needs not such special localities, that his power and his light are spread all over the world and surely in all places without exception? This question here is, why does the zendo have walls? How can the zendo have walls? How can the church have walls? Now, such a feeling and such an experience has always meant the coming to birth of what I call, Spiegelberg calls, the religion of no religion. In all ages of the history of humankind, there have been people who wanted to separate special holy places from other parts of the world, which obviously they thought to be unholy in some way, or even which they made unholy by this very separation, or even which they made unholy by this very separation. The word profane, profanus, means outside the temple. We can see such places of sanctity all over the world. The temples of Egypt, Greece, and Rome always had special areas surrounded by stone walls where people were only allowed to enter after certain preparations. Precautions had to be taken so that neither the god could be insulted by profane people, nor could these men be hurt by the too strong holiness of the atmosphere, which filled such places with magic powers. We call these magic powers mana, which is taboo. These old customs are not at all strange to our minds, for today also we try to make a fence around our ego and around all its belongings on earth. Students of folklore and psychologists have shown us that every soul diagram, as well as every cosmic diagram, begins with a framing line, round or quadrangular. Perhaps we fear that our self-consciousness would fall into pieces or would dissolve itself into the chaos around if not bound by some girdle which does not allow it to grow and expand too widely. We'll stop there. But I want to touch upon a few. This is the introduction to his meditation on the unbounded religion of no religion. When he turns more specifically to Zen, he says, Zen means the complete overcoming of all religious ideas and special religious actions. It is the prototype of the religion of non-religion, one that marks the non-differentiation between holiness and secular life. He says, we may say that the only ceremony of Zen is to have no ceremonies at all, and its only rule of life is to do nothing specially for Zen, for religion, but only to go on and on and on. The only ethical law which has been formulated by Zen masters is the very short formula, walk on. Walk on. Walking on walking, underfoot earth turns, streams and mountains never stay the same. This is the refrain in an American Buddhist sutra, mountains and rivers without end. The only ethical precept in Zen, he says, is walk on. walk on. But then he makes one more move in his presentation and says, but a religion of non-religion, such as Zen, is only perfect if there is not any fear of religion. Religion does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. A religion of non-religion is only perfect if there is not any fear of religion. Now, this is, I think, beautifully congruent with the Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra, taking us into a place where religion does not exist and its non-existence also does not exist. And I think it's a very powerful practice for us to meditate on. It's something I think we'll be meditating on in the coming session. And you can substitute many encounters for religion in this way of thinking. Mark does not exist, and his non-existence also does not exist. The Zendo does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. This is the heart of wisdom. Religion does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. That stop sign does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. Go down the list as you walk on. With each encounter, that turkey does not exist. And its non-existence also does not exist. And how does it feel when you say this about your loved ones? Mary does not exist. And her non-existence also does not exist. Very good practice for understanding what you're attached to. My house does not exist, and its non-existence also does not exist. These words do not exist, and their non-existence also does not exist. This is the heart of wisdom. Yeah, it's hard to find.
Yeah, it looks that way.
there was one, in addition to the pamphlet, this is one thing about the Stanford Libraries, is that there are all of these really rare books tucked away, and the librarians don't know they're really rare books, so I check them out and keep them on my shelf. But this should be in the archive.
Okay.
Because it was, it should be in the archive at the university. But it was also published in a limited 600-volume edition by a little private press in Palo Alto, and with some other Spiegelberg essays. I could pass that around. But I think I can make a copy for you.
Really?
I could make some copies and put them in our library. I'll do that.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. The heart of wisdom is a meditation on emptiness. From the standpoint of emptiness, everything exists and does not exist. There is no boundary. And when Spiegelberg was writing about this church that he encountered, he's having his cosmic consciousness experience, and he comes across this bounded, set off space, right? That from one point of view is a special holy place. But that only exists, this sacred place only exists in relation to the profane space, so-called profane space that is outside. So the point of view of emptiness is to take those walls away, to not have a boundary. We're going to, in the study session, look at a translation of the Heart Sutra by Kaz Ta-Nehisi that doesn't use the word emptiness, but uses the word boundlessness. Right? No barriers, no borders, no boundaries. Is that? And I think the Hafiz poem too. These categories that we create. I think this is one of the great contributions of the emerging interfaith or interspiritual dialogue, is a breaking down of these categories: Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, Jew, Christian, and so forth, which are only inventions, 19th century inventions. Prior to scholarship in the field of religious studies, which emerged in the late 19th century, Religionswissenschaft, the scientific study of religion. With the exception of Islam, which is a more complicated case in terms of the vocabulary of how Muslims identify or define themselves, we didn't have Hindus or Buddhists or Jews or Christians as these world religions categories. People inside these categories only thought of themselves as people of the way, people who are living as true human beings, right? And as scientific research does, it became necessary to create a vocabulary and a language for the purposes of classification and examination and study, right? Hinduism is a particularly complicated issue in this regard. I mean, there is no such thing as Hinduism. In fact, all of these isms are very problematic. I mean, if you look at South Asia, there's just a vast array of folk religious practices that have grown up over the centuries. And they're very localized, right? And they're very specific, and there are many deities specific to the place, right? And from a scientific scholarly point of view, this is a mess. And we have to clean it up and organize it so that we can know what it is, right? Right? And so what's happened is not only have we created these categories which create divisions, right? But then the next step has been that we've reified them. We've taken what are actual processes and movements, historical developments, all of these, including our own practice here, is constantly changing, evolving, right, in various ways. And we put the ism on it, and we want to have, you know, certainty, dogma, doctrine, predictability. You know, these people do this. Those people do that. We don't do that. They do that, right? And so I think we're at a very interesting time in relation to all of this, because it was very useful, because the categories we create help us see things, right? Without the language, certain things do not become visible or available to us, right? So we have had this period of time for about 100 years, let's say from 1858 to 1958, of creating categories and classifications and understanding the vast range of faith traditions around the world, and traditions and practices and teachings and scriptures, right? I say 1958 because that's when Houston Smith published his book, The Religions of Man, as it was called at the time, and basically created for a large readership the general category of world religions, right? Actually, most of you probably know that book, right? Houston Smith's book, The Religions of Man. Actually, started as a television program in St. Louis, Missouri, in 1956. When television was about education, that was the original vision for television. And then it became another vehicle for advertising, just as the web is becoming another vehicle for advertising. And this was the introduction to Americans, for Americans, of Hindus and, I mean, Buddhists. I mean, people really, you know, it was such an unusual, I mean, it was a category that was just beginning to enter our all these categories were just beginning to enter our vocabulary. Actually, Spiegelberg wrote a book published a book in 1957 called Living Religions, which is much better than Houston Smith's book, but Spiegelberg wasn't on television. And but so many people, including me, when I traveled around the world, I had Houston Smith's book, and so now I am meeting Taoists, and now I am meeting Jews, and you know, so this has all been very, very valuable. In part because it created an awareness of the differences, but it also created the possibility now of making connections. And Spiegelberg also published a Bible of World Religions, where he went and found the various scriptures and put them all together, a compendium. And I think this is now the world we're heading into, because we have the information we need in order to be able to engage in the dialogues that ought to really bring us together across these boundaries that we've created. And so that's a very, very exciting time for us to be in. At the same time that that's happening, the fastest growing world religion is the religion of the market, market capitalism. And I think what's happening is that the people in all of these other categories are starting to understand that they have more in common with each other than people who are fully invested in the religion of the market. This is very interesting, I think, as a development, and one we can all participate in. And I think the way to participate, or certainly a way to participate, is to take advantage of the many opportunities that are now available for interfaith dialogue. There are interfaith study centers and interfaith community groups springing up at least all over the Bay Area, but also in many places all over the world. Yeah.
So is the religion of wealth included in that interfaith exchange?
It is open to Stanford. Yeah, I know. It is sure. I mean, prosperity Christianity is invited. Everyone is invited into the conversation, because it's really only in the dialogue that transformation happens.
There's a facet of people, you know, many religions who are engaged in something that's difficult to talk about, that I think a couple movies I've heard about address. There are Bollywood movies, because apparently Western movies don't. A Wednesday and Black and White are two of them. And they talk about a common man, a husband, a banker, a school teacher, just somebody that gets this idea. And he becomes a terrorist.
That's the motivation for Eboo Patel's Interfaith Youth Corps, right there. I mean, because there is all kinds of education going on, and certain parts of the spectrum are very organized for education that leads to terrorism and destructive activities of all kinds. So the vision is there needs to be another effort on another side to create love and harmony and constructive activity. And he's very clear about how urgent this is in the present circumstances. Especially since the religion of the market has created absolutely devastating conditions for billions of people who have very little hope. I mean, the bottom billion is quickly becoming the bottom 2 billion, people who live on less than a dollar a day and are barely getting by. And I think, the opportunities for making connections across these boundaries are all around us, and they're also very important for nurturing our own practice. As Wittgenstein said, if you know only one language, you really don't know any languages. That knowledge of what you know comes through the effort of dialogue and comparison. Right? Oh, you have a self in your tradition, right? Well, we're interested in not self, right? And in that kind of dialogue, well, what does that mean? You get to a place where the self exists, and its non-existence also does not exist. And that's the open space beyond religion. Where the mother of Buddhas dwells. With the Prajnaparamita sutras in one hand and the Vajra diamond sword in the other, well, she meditates with the cosmic mudra and holds it all together. Right? Prajna, the open space beyond religion, wisdom. Pra, before nya, jnana, knowledge. The place before knowledge. Prajna. Emptiness, openness. Right. Yeah.
So for people who are deeply involved in knowledge, I'm just wondering what pre-knowledge means to them that have spent their entire life at it.
Saved by the Bell. There's just so much unlearning to do. Mm-hmm. The fascinating thing about the Heart Sutra, though, it's very much about unlearning. And it very much honors the learning that one does to get that brings one to the point of unlearning. And the sutra is dismantling Abhidharma studies, Abhidharma analysis, each step of the way. Because probably the most interesting, I think, theory about the composition of the Heart Sutra is that it was written by or composed by a Sarvastivadin monk who had a conversion experience that undermined all of the learning that had happened up until that point in his life. And we'll go into that during the session.